Welcome to today's interview on Brighteon.com. I'm Mike Adams, the founder of Brighteon, and today we are joined by author Dick Russell, who's a New York Times bestselling author, and he's the author of the new book that's just come out called The Real RFK Jr., Trials of a Truth Warrior. Excuse me. It's available on Amazon.com and other booksellers as well. Mr. Russell, thank you for joining me today, and I really look forward to this interview to ask you what you learned and what you've written about RFK Jr. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mike. Good to be with you today.
It's great to have you on. Now, tell us just a bit. I mean, the book has just come out. It's from Skyhorse Publishing. That's the publisher. You're the author. How did this come to be, and how were you able to put this together? It seems so quickly.
Well, I started it a year ago in the summer, which was long before Bobby came out and said he was going to run for president. I've known him for more than 20 years. We first met around environmental issues. One was I was doing a book called Eye of the Whale, which was about the gray whales in Baja, Mexico, that were being threatened, their habitat, where they come to have their young every year by a big industrial salt works that Mitsubishi and the Mexican government were planning to build there. And Bobby was involved as an environmental lawyer for the Natural Resources Defense Council. And both he and I would go there. We're there visiting the whales. I mean, if anybody's ever done this, it's an amazing experience at Laguna San Ignacio. You go and you're actually petting whales in the wild.
Wow.
And the mothers are introducing their babies. And it's just, you know, it's an incredible, otherworldly, actually, experience. And so that's where I met him. Was around that. And then both he and I were sports fishermen, and I had written a book called Striper Wars in 2005 about the fight to save the Atlantic striped bass. He was very involved with the same fish, working to curb the pollution on the Hudson River, which he was very successful at. So that was really the beginning of our relationship, was around the environment. And then we just had a lot of other things in common over time, and worked on some other projects together. And then after his book, The Real Anthony Fauci, came out, and he was being just vilified by the major media, as a lot of people know. I mean, this has been going on for some time, but you know, he was being labeled anti-vaxxer and conspiracy theorist and wacko, crazy. And I had known this guy for a long time, and I knew what he'd accomplished. And I thought, you know, this is really wrong. And something, when Skyhorse Tony Lyons came to me and said, you know, some people had been suggesting that maybe there should be a biography of Bobby Ritten. And he said, I know you're really busy, which I was, but you know, I felt, yeah, I'm the guy, the right guy to do this, because
wow,
I know him really well. And I feel like I can, you know, so he basically opened a lot of doors for me. I mean, this was not an as told to, per se, you know, it was not something that I ghost wrote. I had the independence of a biographer to write the truth as I saw it about this individual. And so I traced his whole life. But he gave me access to his private journals in some cases.
Oh, wow.
Through the years, which was pretty great, you know, and he also opened doors to interview friends of his and acquaintances. And so I set out on this trail, and suddenly, you know, a few months ago, it took on a whole nother dimension, because I was writing a book, a biography of a presidential candidate, which
right,
I had not expected to do when I started this project.
Well, let me ask you a question right up front, though. Just, I'm sure the audience is asking this now, and just to be clear, you know, I consider RFK Jr. to be an American hero, a real treasure to this nation. Even though I may not politically agree with him on certain issues, it's so far beyond that. The man he is transcends politics, and yeah, that's what's extraordinary about him. But our audience might be asking, is it possible that your coverage of him has been shaded or biased by your friendship with him, and that it might have caused you to gloss over perhaps mistakes he made or legitimate criticisms against him in the past? Is that an issue that has come up?
Well, I've really done my best to not fall into that trap. I mean, Bobby's been through some very tough stuff in his life, and I knew going in, and so did he, that I couldn't just gloss over that you know, it had to be talked about to some degree anyway, along with his successes. He had some failures, and especially in his early years, you know, he was not surprisingly traumatized by the death of first his uncle, JFK, and then his father, who was assassinated when he was only 15, just turned 15. So it was a really hard time for him. I mean, the whole family, of course, but he was a particularly vulnerable young age, you know, to go through that. And he went through a time of rebellion anyway in the 1960s at that point. But he was like, he went out, you know, there was one summer he just took off. And I guess it was the summer of 69, might have been 1970, I forgot now. But he just took off and again went out there and lived with bums. You know, he rode freight trains with hobos and went to Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco. And nobody really even knew where he was. And he wanted it that way. So I chronicle that too, because, you know, he also learned a lot. I think that was the way I see it, is that was sort of the beginning of his real connection to he'd always loved animals. And he was growing up, he wanted to be a veterinarian, and, you know, and his parents encouraged that. But, you know, I think he was able to connect in those early years of after the tragedy to just regular people, you know, starting with bums, you know, and on the freights, and then going to Latin America. He had a mentor, a really amazing guy named Lem Billings, who had been his uncle JFK's best friend all the way back to when they were in school together at Choate in the 1930s. And after the death of his father, Lem took Bobby under his wing and took him to a ranch in Colombia that he had and other parts of Latin America to introduce him to people, again, who had very little, you know, the campesinos. And Bobby just loved being there, loved being with these people. And so he was able to connect, you know, the positive side of what happened to him at that age was that he was able to connect to folks like that. At the same time, he was going through a crisis of addiction, which went on for a long time. And, you know, he and I sat down and talked about this, how to address this. He didn't want to avoid it. In fact, he found that being in AA, which he went into in 1983, Alcoholics Anonymous, was a huge turning point in his life that he continued to honor and respect. And he still goes to meetings to this day. Wow. And he's helped a lot of people. I mean, literally hundreds of people with, you know, similar problems that he worked through in order to become, you know, an environmental lawyer and advocate.
He's always struck me as someone who's very compassionate, very, very human, really cares about other human beings. And that's, you know, that's something that I feel like I really resonate with him on that point. And even caring for animals and their habitat. And just so that you know where I'm coming from in the audience, you know, I'm a pro Second Amendment, pro firearms person, and I own lots of firearms, and I've never shot an animal. And I do not hunt because I can't, my compassion, even wild hogs on my ranch in Texas, I say hello to them. I don't shoot them, which is very different from a lot of other people who tend to have firearms in places like Texas. But I've always had that empathy for other conscious beings, whether they might be a wild hog, which has a family, has a memory, has consciousness, has a first hog perspective, you could say, not first person, but first hog perspective. And I feel like when I'm talking to Bobby, that he has this empathy, this love for humanity and for our planet and for the animals. And it just exudes from him. And I feel like with so many people out there in the political spectrum who don't seem to give a damn about their fellow human being, nor animals, nor habitat, nor the ocean, the microplastics, pollution, heavy metals, whatever, Bobby Kennedy just really stands out as someone who cares. It's not a slogan, it's not an act. It's who he is.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. That's the guy that I know too. And, you know, he's learned a lot. I mean, he's a falconer, you know. I went on a falconing expedition with him one time, and he does these a lot. He takes people out into the wild, and falconing is an ancient sport, you know, where you train the birds to that they'll come to you and land on your arm, and And he's been doing that for a long, long time and has this real passion for birds, you know, and as well as animals. And he had a whole menagerie when he was growing up, and had a pet lion cub that he received, which was, what was the name, the nickname of it? It was like Bad Boy. That was the name of his lion cub. He was given to him by a friend of his father's, the TV talk show host, Jack Parr, brought it back from Africa, and he raised this lion cub.
Wow.
Till it got bigger, and then, you know, they had to finally give it away. But it's real in him. I mean, his love for the outdoors. But he also says, and has made a point of saying this in many speeches, that, you know, we're not just saving the birds and the bees and the animals, you know, for their sake. But it's for how they enrich us, how the, you know, the feeling that exists between, you know, man and beast, man and bird, and so that's a real thing in him, and it's made working on environmental issues and public health issues too, you know, something that's from the heart and the gut. I mean, he is he's a guy who, he's got a lot of courage, and
yeah.
He learned a lot of that, you know, whitewater rafting these wild rivers in Latin America and later in Canada. He'd take people out on these expeditions, which I write about in the book too, to some degree, you know, that could be quite scary.
Yeah.
With waterfalls and, you know, major, you know, sinkholes, house holes that could fall into. And there were a couple times when he was lucky to have survived that.
Yes.
But it was... So yeah, I mean, the Kennedy thing, right, is you test yourself and you take risks and you learn the importance of that, as well as the conversations at the dinner table where you learn how to debate and argue out points, and all of that, of course, served him in good stead when he became a lawyer later on.
Let me just mention to people, sorry to interrupt, but I want to mention there's an audiobook version available also. So yeah. If you go on Amazon.com or Audible.com, there's an audiobook, there's a Kindle version, and then there's the hard copy coming, yep. All coming out. Perhaps
out.
By the time they're out. Okay. So when people see this interview, it should be available. I mean, there's only going to be a 1 day delay. And I also want to mention that Kennedy24.com is the website for if you want to make a campaign donation to Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And it's critical to do so, if you want to do so before July 1st. Let me just bring that up. Kennedy24.com. Make a donation before July 1st, because I think that's a milestone reporting day for the Federal Elections Commission. And join his email list as well. Here you see Reclaim Democracy. Email, phone number, name, and zip. And right there, you can join his campaign. Now, he has not, of course, been offered large money from probably the pharmaceutical companies or the oil companies or the pesticide companies or any of these other big companies. So that tells you something, doesn't it, Dick? I mean, that RFK Jr. is not owned by corporate America, is he?
He sure is not. You know, he's if anything, he is a danger to certain aspects of corporate America, that not all of it. I mean, he's a free market capitalist, is the way he talks about himself. He believes in the free market, but he just doesn't see that that's what's really happening anymore in our country, that it's mostly socialism for the rich, these huge subsidies going to oil and gas and coal companies and pharmaceutical companies.
Yeah, too. Corporate welfare.
It's corporate welfare. Call it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's, you know, the definition years ago of fascism, when Mussolini was in power in World War II, was a merger of the state and corporate powers.
That's right.
And my fear is, and I think his too, certainly, and that's what he's fighting for. He's fighting to salvage democracy. Yeah, he's a fighter for democracy and for the middle class, which he sees as disappearing in this country. And the gap between rich and poor becoming wider all the time, and certainly it widened during the pandemic, you know, where I think it's 500 new billionaires were created. And many people recently, of course, as far on the lower end of society, lost their food stamps.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, the inequities are huge, And that's what he is out there to address. And I think we're in a desperate time.
We really are. Yeah, we're seeing the destruction of the middle class. The middle class American dream is all but vanished. The billionaire rich are getting richer and owning more, controlling more. And the poor, the number of poor is growing substantially as the economic policies, I would call it crony capitalism, is kind of what's happening right now, is disastrous. And it's not only disastrous under, I would say, of course, Joe Biden, but also that same trend was taking place under Trump as well. So this is not one party versus another party. This is the structure of our economy. It's not structured in an egalitarian way where real people have a shot. Can I ask you about the JFK assassination and his father's assassination as well? And then Bobby has said publicly recently that he has some fear, or I don't know if he used the word fear, but he's concerned that they may try to assassinate him if he were to become president. And I think that's a legitimate fear. Did you talk with him about that, or is it in the book at all, or what are your thoughts on that subject?
Yeah, well, it's a big subject. I'll start by saying he has really good security, and that's by design. I have done three books on the assassination of his uncle. First one I published in 1992, so some years before I ever met Bobby. And I knew a lot about his father's assassination as well. I never felt comfortable talking about the fact that I'd even written those books, when I first got to know him, because our relationship was around the environment, and I didn't know wasn't anything I wanted from him about that, and I didn't know if he'd be comfortable talking about it, and he wasn't until I think it was 2008, or with myself it was like 2013, the 50th anniversary of his uncle's assassination, when he started to want to know. I never even talked about it, but he found out that I'd written these books, and so he wanted to know what I knew. And he had read a book by Jim Douglas called JFK and the Unspeakable, which it's an incredible book. And it's about that era and the forces responsible for having eliminated his uncle. So he has finally come out recently and talked very publicly about the fact that he believes, and with good reason, because there's a lot of evidence to support this, that elements of the CIA not the CIA per se, but elements, rogue elements, worked with Cuban exiles and mob figures and people like maybe H.L. Hunt, the Texas oil man who hated Kennedy, to eliminate him in 1963. And then in 68, Bobby went to see Sirhan in prison. I don't know how many people know that, but it happened just a few years ago. And he did advocate for Sirhan's parole, for his release. Sirhan was, as most people know, the accused killer of his father, accused assassin. He was definitely in the pantry of the Ambassador Hotel. He fired shots. But what a lot of people may not realize is that those shots, and there were 13 found in the pantry, in the wall, and also that hit people. There were only 8 bullets in Sirhan's gun. Sirhan was firing from one direction, from the front, and Robert Kennedy was killed from behind.
Do you mean the capacity of his firearm was only 8 rounds?
Yes, that was the capacity.
Was it a semi-automatic pistol?
No.
It was a revolver?
Yeah, it was a revolver.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was a revolver.
Okay.
So that's the number of bullets that were in it and were found, that had landed somewhere.
Okay.
And there were 13. This was covered up by the LAPD, by the way, for a long time, but what happened that night has never been adequately explained. And the other aspect of this is that Sirhan, to this day, and even at the time in court back in those days, he has no memory of what happened. He doesn't remember going into the pantry. Now, you could say, well, maybe he just has selective amnesia or something, but there was such a thing going on at that time, and who knows where it is today. But the CIA had a program called MKUltra. It used to be called Project Artichoke before that. I've looked into this pretty extensively. And it was a program designed to counter the Russians and what they were doing during the Cold War, but also to figure out, could you control human behavior through the use of hypnosis and drugs?
Right.
And could you even create assassins doing that? There are records that still exist that show that the CIA was trying to do this in the mid-1950s.
Yes. So I think our audience is, they're all familiar with at least the concept of MK Ultra, and that it's, in fact, many documents have been declassified surrounding it. So yeah, you're on the right track. So Sirhan believes that perhaps he was drugged and set up as a patsy for this, or what's he saying?
He says he told Bobby that day in the prison that he said, I did not kill your father and I don't remember what happened.
Huh.
So that's all he knows.
Well,
there was a girl, there was a famous story, I guess. We don't have to go too far into the weeds on this, but there was a girl in a polka dot dress that was seen by others right before Sirhan went into the pantry with him and looking like they were giving him a message. So was that some kind of trigger word to get him in the right place at the right time to fire the shots that he would get arrested as the assassin?
Right.
We don't know.
But. Well, I'm convinced it was, especially the assassination of his uncle, of President JFK, was no question in my mind that was a CIA-related operation. And yeah. What I think is so fascinating and somewhat horrifying about stepping back and realizing where we are now and why RFK Jr.'s attempt at the presidency is so critical for America is because I believe, and I think most of our audience believes, that the United States of America has been a captured regime under the control of a deep state cabal since the assassination of JFK.
I believe the same thing. I believe that there was a coup d'etat that day that has never been resolved. Even though at least 60 some percent of the American people believe there was a conspiracy. And in fact, the House Select Committee on Assassinations in the 1970s concluded just the opposite of what the Warren Commission said, was that there was indeed a conspiracy, meaning more than one shooter.
Yes.
It wasn't just Lee Harvey Oswald, if it was Lee Harvey Oswald at all. And, I think there was a cover-up that happened for different reasons. Not everybody was part of this evil cabal, but I believe what happened, and there's pretty good evidence for this, was that Earl Warren, who was in charge of the Warren Commission, put in charge by the new president, Johnson, was told, look, we got to just let this rest because Oswald has these ties to the Russians and the Cubans, and if the truth comes out, we're going to have World War III. Now, this was a cover story. I mean, this was not, I'm not saying it's Johnson's cover story, but the people who really pulled this off were not Russians or Cubans, but it was made to look that way.
Right. And it's, in retrospect, first of all, I think a lot of Americans today, after having lived through the Trump years and they've seen how the deep state went after Trump and created a fake dossier and so on, all these things. And then the COVID years and all the different shenanigans that went on, I think a lot more Americans are willing to take a look back at the past of significant events like JFK's assassination with a fresh look and to reconsider the evidence of malfeasance, corruption, cover-ups, what have you, because now people have lived through perhaps parallel examples of government or institutions or rogue elements of government taking away their freedoms and rights and exerting power in a non-democratic way, right? Your thoughts, go ahead.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. We had an event back then that we've never come to terms with as a country, and in a sense, it's been a creeping decay ever since. I mean, we've just moved into this now a morass where people can't talk to each other anymore. You're either woke or you're not woke, or you're this or you're that, and there's no civil discourse. There's no, I mean, we're just in a really desperate state, and I think it began 60 years ago this year.
Yeah,
and that people also are really still interested. I've been struck by it. I mean, lots of people I talk to. I'm doing a podcast series for the 60th anniversary with Rob Reiner and Soledad O'Brien, where It's going to be a 10-part series that really delves into what really did happen to JFK.
I would love to invite you back on, by the way, just to talk about your previous work with the JFK assassination. I was good friends with the late Jim Mars.
Yeah, and I knew Jim.
Yeah, and Jim, you know, he was a very methodical researcher and so on, dearly missed. But I would love to have you on again to talk about JFK. But let's bring it back to Robert F. Kennedy Jr. right now, if you don't mind. And no, you mentioned how the country is so divided right now. One of the things that strikes me about Bobby here is that he brings people together. He's a healer. I have a lot of conservative leaning friends, obviously, and so many of them want to vote for Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
Yeah, well, I know and they should, because he is somebody that he's worked. I spell this out a lot in the book with various chapters. He learned very early how to work with people that didn't necessarily share all of his views on things, and so he worked with a Republican upstate senator in New York, a farmer, that hated him when they first met, and they learned how to work together to help craft the New York Watershed Agreement to protect the water supply for everybody upstate and in New York City. He did it again, you know, a number of times. He worked with a Republican businessman in New York State to stop hydraulic fracturing, fracking in that area, because people realized that it was harming the environment and harming people. So, you know, he worked with commercial fishermen. He's worked with farmers. I mean, he for all of his wealth and privilege, which of course he grew up in, he's a regular guy in a lot of ways, and he's fun to be with, and he likes to, you know, he can have a good time with a famous actor like his friend Alec Baldwin, or with the, you know, the commercial fisherman or the cop, you know, he worked with on getting stronger environmental laws passed in New York. So I think that's what people are responding to is that he does give a damn, you know, he's somebody who sincere. His passion isn't made up. He's not a quitter. You know, once he's a dog on a bone. You know, with people with issues that he feels are real, and it doesn't matter. You know, this whole public health issue. He's lost so many friends and family members have turned against him.
Oh yeah, that's what's extraordinary. But you know, what I love about him is that he has been through what many of us have been through in terms of censorship, of being vilified, falsely accused, smeared through the corporate media. And honestly, I don't think that a person is qualified to be the president of this country unless they have been dragged through those experiences, as many of us have in independent media, or perhaps that even you might be strongly criticized for writing a book about RFK Jr., who knows? But we all, those of us who dare to tell the truth about any issue, or at least the truth as we see it, you know, in good faith as we see it, we are vilified, we are deplatformed, we are demonetized, we are cast as villains in society. And so when I see that happening to RFK Jr., it makes me know that he understands the need for debate, for conversation, for freedom of speech. You know, you can't say, the consensus is clear in science, and we achieve consensus by banning all dissenting views. You know, that doesn't work, but that's exactly what's happening today. And Bobby won't put up with that. He will support freedom of speech because he has been through this. At least that's my understanding. What do you think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's been going through it now for more than 10 years. You know, I mean, he used to be the darling of the New York Times, for example. He could publish an op-ed on any environmental issue that was happening.
Right.
And did many times. And also most of the other liberal media, so-called, you know, where where they would, you know, he'd be on all these shows. He was giving lectures all over the country and all over the world, making a very good living doing that. Suddenly it was all gone. He hasn't been able to write an op-ed for the Times or any other big paper, I think, since, I don't know, 2010, 2011, somewhere in there. And he can't even get a letter to the editor published. He can't refute what's being said about him.
Yes, right.
I mean, there's something wrong with this. And now, I mean, all of these articles coming out, it's really pretty outrageous what they label him as. I mean, as if the guy's crazy. I mean, you know, he was, I don't know if you saw his talk with Bill Maher the other night. It was really good. And you know, they were having a great time together, but it was real. You know, they were willing to go at it on certain things and find common ground. And that's what you say. It's all about conversation. It's all about relationships. I mean, that's how you get things done, is you forge relationships with people that, you know, you don't always agree with. And he's capable of doing that. And you know, he's in the sense he's a healer. I mean, I'm thinking about it now as we talk, you know. I mean, he has had to heal internally from the scars of the external events, of course, that killed his family members. But you know, he's had to, you know, bring those parts of himself together and forge a much stronger individual with true spiritual values. I mean, he is a spiritual guy.
Yes.
And a psychological thinker, you know?
Yes. Well, absolutely. I completely agree. Now, but let me ask you this. How would he be as president? Because the stresses and also the deep state threatens you, right? I'm sure that this kind of conversation happens to every president that they want to control. They just say, look, the minute after you win the election, they just have a meeting with you. You know, deep state comes in. This is my guess. They come in, CIA, whoever, they say, look, you're going to do what we want you to do, or we're going to murder your entire family. And
I think,
yeah.
I think that's happened in the past. And I mean, Jesse Ventura told me a story. I did 5 books with Jesse Ventura. And one of the first things he talked to me about was once he got elected independent governor of Minnesota, the first thing that happened was, you know, that suddenly he realizes there's a CIA in Minnesota. And they all said to talk to him about how, you know, we're with the CIA and we're keeping tabs on you. And then, of course, he runs off to Cuba and goes to see Fidel Castro not too long after. Because Ventura didn't take any crap either. But, you know, it will not be certainly easy. But it wasn't easy for his father and his uncle either. I mean, look what they went through and how close we came when he was a boy in 1962 to, you know, Armageddon, annihilation, nuclear holocaust, if the Joint Chiefs of Staff had had their way, and if those two brothers had not been in power,
yes,
then I would be sitting here talking.
That's right. You're referring to the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We were so close to annihilation.
We were, and so, you know, Bobby lived through that, and that's why he talks today about how he wants to. He's a Kennedy Democrat. He wants to be a peace candidate. He wants to end that war in Ukraine.
Yes.
And have a dialogue with, you know, a guy he really can't stand, Vladimir Putin. But, you know, he would talk to him.
Right. And so did his uncle. Right. Exactly. I mean, that's the way. If you're a leader of a country, you talk to other countries' leaders, which the current the Joe Biden group is not talking to Putin. And so how do we possibly avert World War III if they won't talk to each other? But anyway, you can comment, but that's, I'm getting carried away.
well, you know, it's just like there was no, recently, I guess Blinken went over there, but to talk with the China's premier. But before that, we wouldn't even talk to China.
Yeah.
And you know, that of course, like the example that was set for Bobby was that his uncle, JFK, through a back channel, actually, through a private communication, had this whole relationship with Nikita Khrushchev, his counterpart in the Soviet Union. And they exchanged personal letters over the period of a year after the missile crisis happened, aimed at let's end this thing. We've got to stop nuclear testing in the atmosphere, or we're poisoning our entire atmosphere. And let's cut back on nuclear weapons. And he and Khrushchev were, and with Castro too, you know, we agreed, we're not going to keep trying to kill you, and we're not going to invade your country, and we'll take our missiles out of Turkey. I mean, there were compromises made in the course of conversation that basically saved the world.
Yes.
And you know, that's the kind of thing that Bobby, I think, learned about and would be in a position to fight for if he was elected president, in a way that we're not seeing right now and didn't see under the most recent leadership we've had.
Let me remind our audience here, we're interviewing Dick Russell, the author of the book called The Real RFK Jr., Trials of a Truth Warrior. It's available now in audio formats as well as Kindle and physical formats. It's available everywhere. Dick, let me ask you, knowing what you know about Bobby, if he were to be elected president, do you believe that he would stick to the integrity of his convictions of what he has promised to do, or would he fold under pressure and threats from others?
I don't think so. No, I what I see happening is that he will stand steadfast with what he believes in and will fight for that in terms of what appointments he would make to cabinet positions or ambassadorships or especially federal agencies. You know, he would get rid of the people at the CDC and the FDA and the NIH and the EPA, you know, who are just in bed with these corporate, you know, thugs, basically, you know, the guys who are just running roughshod over us and poisoning our atmosphere and in some cases our kids.
Yeah. And don't forget the USDA in there too.
Yeah. You know, he's a big supporter of regenerative agriculture.
Absolutely.
And of alternative forms of energy. And that's, you know, and then getting rid of the subsidies for oil and gas. I mean, you know, these things are obvious, and yet they haven't been done in any kind of scale that we need to see happen to avert, again, you know, potential future catastrophe. So he doesn't want nuclear power either. You know, I mean, you know, nuclear is, we saw what happened at Fukushima in Japan with the terrible radiation spills into the ocean. And we also see what's happened to the ocean itself, you know, from warming waters and the algae and, you know, the choking off the life of our seas, which we're so vitally dependent upon.
Absolutely. Yeah. But I'm sure you're well aware of this, but, you know, there's a design of a nuclear power plant that has no such risks as that GE constructed plant in Fukushima. The problem is that in a more passively cooled nuclear power plant, they don't have the side benefit of being able to produce byproducts used for nuclear weapons, right? So there is a way to have nuclear energy that could be a whole lot safer, but nobody wants to do it that way because they need the weapons, which brings us back to the war issue, right? War is such a racket, isn't it? It's so profitable for these companies that just, all this money that Biden announces or Blinken announces, we're sending this money to Ukraine. Actually, it's going, most of it's going to the U.S. weapons companies. Into their pockets.
Exactly. Going to Lockheed Martin and Marietta.
Raytheon or whoever, yeah.
Raytheon to become richer by selling the weapons to keep this war going.
Yep.
And you know, it's and again, it's not that Putin's a good guy or Putin is right, but he is. I think one thing that Bobby has, and others too, but he's pointed out, is that we made a promise to the Russians back, I think, when Gorbachev was still in power. And the Berlin Wall fell and all that, and communism disappeared supposedly. But you know, we made a promise that we would not expand NATO along those borders of Russia, and instead, I think there's 14 new NATO countries, and Ukraine was going to perhaps be the next one, and you know, it seemed to be, I guess, the last straw for Putin. I mean, so there is that other factor that. You know, and Bobby's gone through a lot over that. I mean, with the conversations at his dinner table, and you know, his son, his oldest son, Connor, who was in law school, suddenly took off last year in the fall, and just told his dad. He said, "I'm going to disappear for a while. I don't want to tell you where I'm going. Just don't worry, I'll be okay." And then he vanished. And the only reason that Bobby knew, had any idea, he and his wife Cheryl Hines had any idea where Connor was they saw this credit card bill from somewhere in Eastern Europe.
Oh, yeah.
And he ended up going to Ukraine on his own because he disagreed with his father at the dinner table. He felt like, you know, if you're going to, that the plight of that people is so severe that I'm going to join them. And he went there and he fought with the Ukrainian army or with the foreign, one of the foreign legion outfits, you know, for 3 months. I talked to him about it. He faced death. He didn't know. There were times he didn't know if he'd ever come back.
Wow. And
yeah,
that's a kind of a living hell experience. I'm sure that shaped Connor's understanding of events. But critically, with if RFK Jr. becomes president, and I know he believes this, he would need to reestablish a communication style with Russia where America could once again be believed to tell the truth. Because with the Biden administration, they just lie constantly geopolitically. So Russia is, what Russia has learned is that they can never trust what's coming out of the State Department, Blinken or Victoria Nuland or Biden or whoever. They can't trust it. And if you don't have some level of trust, then how do you have a basis for communication? How do you have a basis for de-escalation? I think Bobby would help reestablish trusted communications. Again, we're not endorsing Putin or North Korea or Iran or whoever he needs to talk to, but he needs to be able to talk to them and talk us off the ledge of global annihilation.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think that's the way he honestly feels, that he's going to do everything he can through appointments and personal interchanges, like his uncle had had with Khrushchev. And if it, you know, if it takes a back channel, I mean, he told the story, tells the story of how they, there was a guy with the KGB back in those days, I think it was Bolshakov was his name, who became friends with his father and even came over there to Hickory Hill. And they knew that this guy, you know, the kids knew the guy was with the KGB. That was kind of a big deal, right? But it was he who helped establish this channel of communication with Khrushchev that took us much closer to global peace than we'd known before. Khrushchev, interestingly, you know, didn't make it either past. He was deposed in the autumn of '64 by the hardliners within his country. So you had sort of a parallel event. It had already happened to
right.
to JFK. And of course, when the letters indicate that when Kennedy was killed, that Khrushchev was just, you know, he was in tears. I mean, it really hurt him so badly that this man who befriended him in a correspondence had been taken off the earth.
Yes. These world leaders, if we dare call them leaders, more like crooks in many ways, they're playing with the lives, they're toying with the lives of billions of innocent human beings. And as we're about to wrap up this interview, Dick, I just want to reiterate that I believe that RFK Jr. wants to give power back to individual people to decide their own lives, to keep the product of their own labor, to make their own medical and health decisions, to live in peace without the threat of war, to live in freedom without the threat of surveillance or privacy violations or censorship. Would you agree with that statement?
I would not only agree with it, I'm moved by the way you put it. I think it's, you nailed it all. And, you know, I've had a number of talks with Bobby and watched him with people, and, you know, he's very open-minded. He listens, he studies, he's willing to change his mind. That I think was the great gift that his uncle and his father, you know, gave the world too, is that they were willing to change as human beings while they were in office. JFK started out as a real cold warrior. His brother Bobby, after he was killed, you know, spent months in relative seclusion, you know, reading Camus and the existentialists and the great Greek poets, and suffering. Out of that suffering was born a truly compassionate man who, when Martin Luther King was killed, you know, could address a crowd, a mostly black crowd in Indianapolis, and move them so that they would not and did not riot like was happening in cities all across America, understandably, after Martin Luther King was killed. So, you know, I think that's an inheritance, certainly, in a sense, you know, that he has always valued. He wrote a whole book called American Values about what he took from his family, his experiences like that. And I think he's raised six kids and raised them very well. And I know them, and they're all very different and all devoting themselves to one kind of public service or another. And I think that, you know, he's the man that we need at this point in our history.
Well, Dick Russell, I thank you so much for you undertaking this book project, putting so many hours into this and helping share your understanding of this extraordinary man with all of us. And I believe that if RFK Jr. were to become president, it would be a great gift to this nation and our world, frankly. So let's see how history unfolds here. And I thank you for taking the time with me today, Dick. It's been a pleasure. And I'm serious. I'd love to invite you back to talk about JFK on another episode here, if you're open to that.
Yeah, I'd be glad to do that, Mike. And I've really enjoyed talking with you today. Thanks for having me.
You too. Absolutely. All right, take care then, Dick, and we'll talk again. I'll ask my producers to reach out to you to schedule. Folks, the book is called The Real RFK Jr., Trials of a Truth Warrior. There's the audiobook, and then there's the Kindle version here. It's on Amazon and I would imagine Barnes & Noble and other booksellers. And of course, if you'd like to support RFK Jr. in his candidacy, then go to Kennedy24.com. If you want to make a financial donation to his campaign, please do so before July 1st, because that's when it counts the most in terms of the election commission. And even, I think, setting up for any possibility of debates on the Democrat side. And we want debates. We want Joe Biden and RFK Jr. to have not only a debate, but maybe a push-up contest as well on top of that. So maybe both. How about that? Back to back. But thank you for watching today. I'm Mike Adams, the founder of Brighteon.com. God bless you all. God bless America. Thanks for watching. Today's interview is brought to you by HealthRangerStore.com, where we have, of course, lab-tested almost all certified organic products for health, nutrition, for personal care, for home care. If you take a look at HealthRangerStore.com, you can see here we've got Turmeric Gold Plus, Detox Foot Pads, Colloidal Silver Nasal Spray, Organic Elderberry and Echinacea Extract. This is the one that was formulated by Dr. Ed Group. It's really amazing. We have non-fluoride toothpaste alternatives. This is an amazing toothpaste product that I helped formulate. Aloe vera extract powder. So much more, really hundreds of products. Freeze-dried organic blueberry powder. This is very high in anthocyanins. Just amazing. If you check out the full product line, you'll be blown away by what we have available right now at HealthRangerStore.com, and every purchase helps support this platform and our desire to bring you the truth, to bring you fascinating guests, information that can help you prepare for the madness of the world that seems to have consumed our planet at the moment. My goodness, you're going to need health and nutrition to make it through everything that's coming, because where we are right now is only the beginning. So we appreciate your support, HealthRangerStore.com. Take care. A global reset is coming, and that's why I've recorded a new 9-hour audiobook. It's called The Global Reset Survival Guide. You can download it for free by subscribing to the naturalnews.com email newsletter, which is also free. I'll describe how the monetary system fails. I also cover emergency medicine and first aid and what to buy to help you avoid infections. So download this guide. It's free. It's my gift to you, simply because I want like-minded people to survive.